From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to Episode 11 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. Coming up in this edition of NIH Research Radio, there's some good news to be found in this year's report on the status of America's children. I'll sit down with the editor of the NIH News and Health to discuss a new e-column. Wally Akinso tells us how scientists have learned that a hormone, which can be detected in a simple blood test, can identify people with sickle cell disease who also suffer from pulmonary hypertension. Matt Thornton has a story about how two studies have indicated that autism may involve a lack of connections and coordination in separate areas of the brain. But first, Bethesda was the site for a summit to discuss reducing cancer health disparities. That story coming up in 30 seconds on NIH Research Radio. If you have
claudication,
I don't have to tell you what the word means. You know, it's that muscular leg pain you get during walking caused by poor arterial circulation. If that's something you live with and you're 21 or older, log on to clinicaltrials.gov. If you're accepted, all study-related tests and procedures are provided for free. Call 866-999-1116 for more information. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Cancer researchers, health professionals, and community health advocates came together in Bethesda, Maryland recently for the Cancer Health Disparities Summit 2006. Cancer health disparity refers to the difference in the incidence, burden, and mortality in certain racial and ethnic populations and socioeconomically deprived individuals. The summit featured interactive sessions on a variety of topics centered around the theme, Strengthening Our Culture of Collaborations for Reducing Cancer Health Disparities. Dr. Sonia Springfield, acting director for the Center to Reduce Cancer Disparities and branch chief of the Comprehensive Minority Biomedical Branch at the National Cancer Institute, talked about the objectives of the 2.5-day summit.
What we wanted to do was bring together what I felt were some of the most effective and promising programs that were addressing the areas of cancer health disparities that were funded by the NCI, as well as the National Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities. So we had about 8 of these programs come together, first and foremost, to understand and learn and gain knowledge about each of these various programs. A lot of them are doing some interesting research in areas that they could absolutely begin new collaborations, they can strengthen their current partnerships, and gain better ways of sharing their resources and the talent and expertise in the areas that, again, are effective in reducing cancer burden in minority populations.
Dr. Springfield said the summit was also attended by representatives from all the divisions at NCI, giving an overview of other programs and their commitment to activities within their divisions that are dealing with the burden of cancer in minority populations. She talked about what she thinks the various groups took away from the summit.
I think the group was really re-energized. It was apparent that they were unaware of the many activities and the many programs that NCI was supporting in this area. They got a feel for the NCI commitment from the leadership. They got a renewed sense of hope, I believe. Currently, we are undergoing a course of fiscal constraints, so they're concerned about budget cuts. They're concerned about their programs ending or not getting enough support that's needed to do the various works that they are in the process of doing. I think that they were reassured by the message that we're going to be here through this short period of time and that we'll emerge strong when funds return back into our portfolios and in our programs.
To learn more about the summit, log on to www.cancer.gov/newscenter. Scientists at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute have come up with another way to diagnose a potentially life-threatening complication of sickle cell disease with a simple blood test. Wally Akinso has this report.
A hormone detected in a simple blood test can identify patients with sickle cell disease who have developed pulmonary hypertension. That same hormone, known as brain natriuretic peptide, or BNP, is a clear predictor of death in adult sickle cell patients, according to a study by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Dr. Roberto Machado, lead scientist of the study, says this is an important leap forward in research on sickle cell disease.
These findings are important, I think, for many things. One is that we found a blood biomarker, a test that could be done by ordering a blood test that could sort of suggest the presence of pulmonary hypertension. More importantly, identify patients who are at an increased risk of dying. So what does that mean? That means that we can try and focus on understanding what's happening to these patients better. We can try and focus on developing new treatments for these patients. And we can actually make researchers in the field aware of this complication and aware of these patients. And these patients could be treated in studies that are actually ongoing or coming up down the pike, specifically looking at how would patients fare when they have their sickle cell-related pulmonary hypertension treated. It's important because we raise awareness about this problem. We have another tool to diagnose this problem, and we can sort of provide these patients with avenues to be treated for us to see if we can improve the quality and quantity of life of these patients.
Sickle cell anemia is one of the most common genetic blood disorders in the U.S. About 30% of sickle cell patients have pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary hypertension often leads to heart failure, and it's a major risk factor for death in adults with sickle cell disease. Dr. Machado said, based on these findings and other studies, there's a great benefit to screening sickle cell patients with both echocardiography and blood BNP. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, I'll chat with the editor of the monthly NIH News and Health about a new e-column. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. Every day, researchers are unlocking many of cancer's mysteries. But what's the best way to accurately and effectively communicate this important news to other researchers, doctors, patients, and the public? One trusted source for up-to-date cancer research news and information comes from the National Cancer Institute, the federal government's premier cancer research agency. The NCI Cancer Bulletin is a free weekly online publication that offers a single source for comprehensive coverage of cancer programs and research. In recent weeks, the NCI Cancer Bulletin has reported on higher numbers of cancers in type 2 diabetics, new drugs being effective in women with stage 2 or 3 operable breast cancer, how NCI's budget has been affected by federal belt tightening, and caring for cancer caregivers. You can keep pace with these and other topics by reading the NCI Cancer Bulletin. Visit www.cancer.gov/NCI Cancer Bulletin to sign up for your free electronic subscription today. We're sitting here in my combination studio office on the campus of the National Institutes of Health, and I'm joined by a guy who works just down the hallway from me, Dr. Harrison Wine, editor of the NIH, we call it the NIH. It's the NIH News and Health, which is a monthly feature that we've talked about on this podcast before. But Harrison has a new project going on. Now, this is NIH Research Radio, the podcast you're listening to right now. We also do a 60-second feature that goes out on XM satellite radio and around the country on thousands of radio stations called NIH Health Matters. You've got sort of a, what would you call it, a blog?
We call it an e-column. Yeah.
And it's called NIH Research Matters. What's the concept?
Well, the basic idea is people would always ask, well, what does NIH do? A lot of people just don't realize what NIH's main purpose is, basically. Mm-hmm. They see it popping up in the news here and there. So we wanted to just create something where people could just check in and see all the research that NIH is funding.
So this is a website they can go to. You update it every Friday with the latest news and information right there on their computer screens.
But yeah, every Friday there are 2 to 4 stories. NIH, as you know, funds thousands and thousands of research projects, and these papers are coming out all the time. But we try to pick out some representative papers, some real interesting ones, and just highlight them.
What's your criteria for picking a story?
Oh, we try to do a mix. Some that have some health interest. We try to select papers that are going to have big impact. So sort of the paradigm shifting papers, as scientists like to call it. They always use the word paradigm.
I want to point out to our listeners that this is our 11th edition of NIH Research Radio, and that's the first time the word paradigm has been used. What are some of the features that are on there this time around?
For example, last week we had one about a gene that affects the risk of getting type 2 diabetes. Actually, there were two papers that came out a couple of weeks ago about new genetic clues to dementia, two different types of dementia, different genes involved. And the third story that week was about, you've heard about the blood-brain barrier, where actually there's a barrier between the blood and all organs in your body. And some researchers figured out a way to actually manipulate that barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So our third story is usually more technically oriented, try to give people who are interested in the more technical side
a little reward for the more tech-savvy.
Yeah, exactly. We don't always do that, but we just sort of scan and try to find some interesting things.
Where's the website?
It is, actually, if you go to the NIH homepage, there's a link on the left. It says e-column NIH Research Matters, or you could go to www.nih.gov/news/research_matters.
Just go to the NIH.gov page and push the little button. It's a lot easier, right? Yeah. What's coming up in the next issue of NIH?
The August issue, the cover story is about caregiving and the troubles that caregivers face and the challenges that they face. We're actually getting a much better understanding of the challenges that caregivers face and the ways that we can help them. So research is really illuminating this. It's an interesting cover story. We also have a story about noise pollution, which, as you probably know, is a big and growing problem.
All right, Dr. Harrison Wine, he works just down the hallway from me here, so he's always a great guest at the last minute, and he'll be coming in from time to time to tell us about what we can find on the e-column NIH Research Matters. Harrison, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bill.
By the way, that e-column will update every Friday, but not during the month of August. Watch for weekly updates starting in September. Now, Matt Thornton has this report about research into autism.
Two studies have indicated that autism may involve a lack of connections and coordination in separate areas of the brain. The research was conducted by the Collaborative Program of Excellence in Autism, a research network funded by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development and the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders. In people with autism, the brain areas that perform complex analysis appear less likely to work together during problem solving than in people who do not have the disorder, the researchers suggest. In a separate report, the same research team found that in people with autism, brain areas normally associated with visual tasks also appear to be active during language-related tasks, providing evidence to explain a bias towards visual thinking common in autism. Researchers also found that communications between high-order centers in the brains of people with autism are directly related to the thickness of the anatomical connections between them. The study and theory are the work of Dr. Marcel Just, director of the Center for Cognitive Brain Imaging at the University of Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He talked about the new discoveries.
Well, some of the most exciting new findings are in the studies of brain activation. So asking people with autism and typical controls to perform some task and looking at the brain activity while they're performing the task. One kind of new finding is that the brain areas that become activated are less synchronized in autism. And particularly, it's the areas at the front of the brain, the frontal cortex, that are less synchronized with areas further back in autism. So it's just straight synchronization of the brain activity is lower in autism, particularly involving frontal areas. Another new finding is that the white matter, the actual cables that would carry connections, are different. And the third, and I think this is sort of one of the most exciting things that we've just found, is that there's a correlation between these two results in individuals. People who have lower synchronization between frontal and parietal areas also have a smaller corpus callosum, which is the white matter gigantic fiber bundle that connects the left and the right hemisphere of the brain.
People with autism often have difficulty communicating and interacting socially with people. The saying, "unable to see the forest for the trees," describes how people with autism frequently excel at details yet struggle to comprehend the larger picture. Dr. Just and his colleagues are conducting additional studies to determine the nature of the abnormality of the connections in the brains of people with autism. For more information, visit www.nicd.nih.gov. From the National Institutes of Health, I'm Matt Thornton in Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, There was plenty of good news and some not so good in this year's report on the status of America's kids. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. A key to good health is eating healthy foods. So, when you're dashing around the supermarket, dash to the produce aisle for fresh fruits and vegetables. Dash to the dairy case for low-fat milk products. Dash to the foods that are lower in saturated fat, trans fat, cholesterol, sodium, and added sugars. Dash to the foods that have been proven in the fight against high blood pressure. For more information about the Dash Eating Plan, log on to www.dashplan.org. This message brought to you by the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. There's good news in this year's report on the well-being of America's children. The adolescent birth rate has never been lower. The infant mortality rate is down after increasing last year. The proportion of kids exposed to secondhand smoke has declined, as has the proportion of high school seniors who smoke. Also, average math scores are up for kids in fourth and eighth grade, and the average reading score for fourth graders has increased. These are the highlights of the report called America's Children in Brief, Key National Indicators of Well-Being, compiled by the Federal Interagency Forum on Child and Family Statistics. Dr. Dwayne Alexander is director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at the National Institutes of Health. He said this yearly look at the condition of our nation's children is important.
The America's Children Report gives the American people an annual report card on how the country's children are doing. It measures their progress, or lack thereof, in a wide variety of measures, in education, in health, and their general well-being. By doing so each year, it allows us to track progress over time, things that are going well, things that are not going so well, and for those not going so well, what we need to focus on changing so that we improve that status.
Dr. Alexander pointed to the decrease in the number of kids exposed to secondhand smoke.
One of the most important is that children are exposed to less tobacco smoke than they were a decade ago. 10 years ago, 88% of children had a marker in their blood that indicates exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke. That's gone in 10 years down from 88% to 59%. Still too high, but a major improvement. And this reflects their exposure to secondhand smoke as well as smoke themselves. It's a consequence of several things. Their parents are less likely to smoke in the home, the kids are less likely to smoke themselves, and public laws have outlawed smoking in public places. So all this is combined to reduce the exposure of kids to smoke. This is in combination with the high school seniors being less likely to smoke themselves, down from 14% to 12%. This is a significant improvement and continues a long-term trend. This is extremely important from a public health standpoint because avoiding cigarette smoking is one of the best things people can do to protect their health.
Dr. Alexander said there was more good news to be found in the decline of teen births.
Another positive development recorded in this report is the continued decline of births to teenagers, now at the lowest level ever recorded in the United States. This has been particularly marked in the African American population that had a very high rate to start with. This is extremely important development from a public health standpoint because teens who give birth to infants and the infants themselves are both at high risk for adverse consequences in terms of poverty, adverse health problems, and other disabilities throughout their lifetime.
Yet there was some mixed news in the report. The birth rate for unmarried women and the proportion of infants with low birth weight both increased from the previous year. Yet the infant mortality rate has gone down.
These are opposite trends. Lower infant mortality is good. Higher low birth weight rate is not good. What is particularly striking is that we have achieved a lower infant mortality rate in spite of the fact that a cause of infant mortality, low birth weight, is increasing. And it's because of our research and our application of research in improving the survival of the low birth weight and very low birth weight infants that we're able to improve infant mortality at the same time that the low birth weight rate has gone up. We really need to focus, though, on the problem of low birth weight. It's gone from 7.9 to 8.1%, and that's much too high. Women need to seek care from a health care provider as soon as they discover they're pregnant, keep a regular schedule of prenatal visits, and allow us to detect any problems that are occurring with the pregnancy as soon as possible so that we can intervene and try to prevent low birth weight.
The forum's website at childstats.gov has all the data updates and detailed statistical information from this year's report. An And with that, we come to the end of another edition of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, August 4th, when episode 12 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website. That's www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info right there on the podcast webpage. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.